Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you've come to expect on this show, we begin the show every single day, and we will between now and 2020, November of 2020, with the words of Colonel Vindman in 2019 when he addressed the impeachment trial. And at that time, he was confident that his father had done the right thing, and he assured his father that everything was going to be all right. What we now know today is that it was not all right for him. It was not all right for his brother, and frankly, it's not all right for the country. So you will now hear the words of Colonel Vindman. Have them ringing in your ears when you vote in November.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Let me introduce my guest. My guest is John Nichols. I have known John since 1991, if not before that, actually. And he is a writer for The Nation magazine, and he is prolific. He lives in Wisconsin. So obviously the Wisconsin election was very, very near and dear to his heart. And he followed every single move. And we actually did as well, John. We had Mark Joseph Stern from Slate, and it was like, ba-dum-ba. But okay, that was the U.S. Supreme Court. Then it's the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Then it's the governor. That was like, it was unbelievable. And yet the result may have put people at harm's way because of the pandemic, but the judge to the United States, to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the progressive judge won, which was remarkable. But before we get into Wisconsin, we taped this show the day before it airs. And I heard Barack Obama endorse Joe Biden, John. And there were about 3 minutes in his 11-minute endorsement that I wanted to play for you and for my audience. Because I go back to 2016 and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and it was so tense and so toxic. How times have changed. And I want you to hear with us Barack Obama's comments about this remarkable field that started out and ended up with two old white men. But and then he goes on to talk about Bernie. So will you play it, Ken, please? So
we can all Yes, hear I will. It. Here we go.
Now, Joe will be a better candidate for having run the gauntlet of primaries and caucuses alongside one of the most impressive Democratic fields ever. Each of our candidates were talented and decent, with a track record of accomplishment, smart ideas, and serious visions for the future. And that's certainly true of the candidate who made it farther than any other, Bernie Sanders. Bernie's an American original, a man who has devoted his life to giving voice to working people's hopes, dreams, and frustrations. He and I haven't always agreed on everything, but we've always shared a conviction that we have to make America a fairer, more just, more equitable society. We both know that nothing is more powerful than millions of voices calling for change. And the ideas he's championed, the energy and enthusiasm he inspired, especially in young people, will be critical in moving America in a direction of progress and hope. Because for the second time in 12 years, we'll have the incredible task of rebuilding our economy. And to meet the moment, the Democratic Party will have to be bold. You know, I could not be prouder of the incredible progress that we made together during my presidency. But if I were running today, I wouldn't run the same race or have the same platform as I did in 2008. The world is different. There's too much unfinished business for us to just look backwards. We have to look to the future. Bernie understands that, And Joe understands that. It's one of the reasons that Joe already has what is the most progressive platform of any major party nominee in history. Because even before the pandemic turned the world upside down, it was already clear that we needed real structural change. The vast inequalities created by the new economy are easier to see now, but they existed long before this pandemic hit. Health professionals, teachers, delivery drivers, grocery clerks, cleaners, the people who truly make our economy run, they've always been essential. And for years, too many of the people who do the essential work of this country have been underpaid, financially stressed, and given too little support. And that applies to the next generation of Americans. Young people graduating into unprecedented unemployment. They're going to need economic policies that give them faith in the future and give them relief from crushing student loan debt. So we need to do more than just tinker around the edges with tax credits or underfunded programs. We have to go further to give everybody a great education, a lasting career, and a stable retirement. We have to protect the gains we made with the Affordable Care Act, but it's also time to go further. We should make plans affordable for everyone, provide everyone with a public option, expand Medicare, and finish the job so that healthcare isn't just a right, but a reality for everybody.
So I'm listening to Barack Obama, John Nichols, and I'm thinking, my God, Bernie Sanders has changed the world. In 2015, when he began his campaign, I think a lot of us rolled our eyes and said, how is this possible? And yet what he was talking to were issues that we knew had long been unaddressed. And then you saw what happened with Hillary Clinton, but more importantly, you saw what happened in 2018. Mm-hmm. And then the last two survivors to that 2020 presidential primary turned out to be Bernie and Biden. And Barack Obama's comments about Bernie, I thought were pretty remarkable, and also a recognition of the things that he had left undone himself. Mm-hmm. And that Biden was not only a good man, but a man that would listen to a Bernie and listen to the issues and recognize that there is an urgency and frustration of the moment.
Let's begin with the concept that Barack Obama is the most gracious and nuanced political figure in American politics in the modern era. There is no one to rival him as regards the ability to assess a political circumstance and to bring insight and perspective to it that raises the level of the discussion for everyone involved. And he is a very wise political figure who clearly understands the significance of the moment he is stepping into. In the Democratic Party today, there is a divide. It's a genuine divide. It should not be underestimated between those who have been willing to work with Wall Street and corporate interests over the years, those who have, you know, hewed toward a much more centrist, even center-right path, and a grassroots portion of the party that has believed very strongly that it needs to move to the left. As president, Barack Obama, sometimes with success and sometimes with great challenges, sought to, you know, balance these different perspectives. I think he was always conscious of those realities because he knows the dynamics of political ideology. So he came into this discussion looking to say some things that might make everyone think a little deeper, think a little harder. And I think he did it just about perfect. You know, look, I mean, we could say it however you want, but I would simply suggest that high marks for Bernie Sanders is necessary because his supporters, and frankly, any serious analyst knows that he's transformed our politics and opened up discussions and raised issues that simply weren't there at the level that they should have been. And he needs credit for that, but also he needs to be welcome to the ongoing discussions so that he can be a central figure in framing the party's approach. At the same time, this incredibly important message, and that is that Joe Biden, for all of his imperfections, and they are many, is somebody with an ability to listen and also, frankly, and this isn't getting enough credit, He's frankly a longtime political insider, political player. He actually knows politics. And I think what Barack Obama was saying very wisely is, hey, if you're a smart politician, you will listen to Bernie Sanders. So really important.
So what I'm hearing from Barack and what I'm hearing from Biden, and I heard this expression, I think, from Bill Curry. You know Bill Curry from Connecticut. Very well. And Bill Curry said that what Biden's strength is that he leads from behind. And that, and he's absolutely right. He really does. He's not a forward edge walker thinker change agent. He tends to sort of become the environment in which he's in.
Yep.
And I think that what you heard from Barack Obama was not only he said, I would not be running on the same issues I was running on in 2008 today, that Joe Biden is probably has the most progressive agenda we have ever had. It's not Bernie's, but it's more progressive than any of the Democrats that we've had in a long time. But I also want to remind everyone that up until Bill Clinton, the new Democrat, arrived on the scene, it was a little more like the Feingold, Wellstone Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, and then came Bill Clinton. And yeah. From Bill Clinton came, you know, frankly, Barack Obama, who also was a new Democrat. And if you look at the Democrats that have won in my state of New Hampshire, they're all new Democrats. And what you know about a new Democrat is they tend to sort of look kindly on bankers and Wall Street and whatever. And it's not that they don't care about workers, but they don't necessarily prioritize what's happening to working folks. They care, but not in, I think, the full-fledged way that a Bernie Sanders spoke about for 40 years. And so what I see happening with this endorsement is also a recognition that not only are we living in precarious times, not only do we have Donald Trump, but that the urgency of the moment means the big ideas that Bernie has been talking about aren't actually so big, that they are actually attainable and that they probably are doable. I mean, he talked about healthcare. Although he couldn't say the word Medicare for all, he was talking about it sort of expanding and the right and the public option and everybody gets it. And I mean, if you didn't know what he was saying, you were almost thinking that he was like wanted to say those words, but it couldn't come out of his mouth, you know, because we'd so marginalized that conversation. So I really do think that it's an opportunity. But my question is, how do we get African Americans and young people and Hispanics to recognize that Joe Biden may not be the strongest candidate, but he may be the vessel that could actually get us there? It's kind of like Nixon opening China. Maybe the weakest Democrat can do the most aggressive, progressive things we've ever had. No, I'm serious. I mean, it's like, that's what I think.
So here, Arnie, you're always thinking well. So here's the bottom line. I would only replace one word in what you said. You said doable. I say necessary.
And absolutely. That's
the big difference.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
If it's doable, it's still aspirational. It's like, oh, these are things we'd love to do if we had power, right? Mm-hmm. I think the dialogue has to move to necessary. The fact of the matter is we are in the midst of a pandemic that has shown us how dramatically vulnerable our governing system and our healthcare structures and our economy and everything else is. I mean, and we did a lousy job for the last 50 years, 70 years of, you know, addressing some of those vulnerabilities. We did not plan. We did not put infrastructure in place. We did not, you know, think seriously about, you know, how to make sure that we have a healthcare system. And also, frankly, the capacity to develop the basic materials we need, masks, gowns, ventilators. I mean, this is basic stuff. And a four-year-old could have told you that in a moment of pandemic, if you have offshored your production of those basic necessities, you're going to be, you know, struggling in a global market to get, you know, masks and gowns and ventilators, right? And so that's basic planning. That's what countries like Germany and other places did. And we didn't do it because we rejected socialism. We always said, oh, that sounds socialist. We can't do that. We can't plan. We can't organize. We can't begin to do certain things. Bernie Sanders came forward and said, hey, I'm a socialist. And now let's start talking about stuff. That was the huge transformational moment because he took the power away from those who always dismiss stuff as being socialist and said, yeah, it is. Okay, let's do it. And now we are in this necessary moment. And the truth of the matter is, are there a couple of libertarian solutions to some of our challenges? Yeah, probably. But are there also some socialist solutions to our challenges? Yes, absolutely. So and I think that's where, just the key thing is, that's where the Democrats, when I start talking about necessary, they can embrace some pretty radical ideas and simply say, this isn't aspirational anymore. This is what we have to do going forward.
Can I just add to that concept of it being necessary and not just aspirational and say it was necessary even before we had this pandemic problem?
Of course, yeah.
Throughout this campaign for the last year, it's been very clear to me anyway, and I think to you as well, John, that and Tarni, that it's necessary for the Democratic Party to move forward to, whether you call it socialist or not, to a more progressive government that actually pays attention to and acts on behalf of all of the people and not just the very wealthy. And frankly, as you said, the last 50 years, probably, our country has not been doing a very good job of either running an economy or a government that is anything other than a Wall Street corporatist supporting entity. And we really need to move to it. And that's what the Democratic Party was doing during the primaries, I think. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were both, that was their whole message long before the pandemic came along and said, we have to do it or we're going to die.
Well, you're right. But you see, now what's changed is, as the New York, what I think will become perhaps the classic headline of the period in the New Yorker, reality has endorsed Bernie Sanders. The fact of the matter is that even into this campaign, Brilliant. Sanders and Warren and Julian Castro and at his best, Cory Booker, I mean, all these candidates, Kirsten Gillibrand, were up there, you know, basically outlining a vision that was far more progressive than where we'd been. Unfortunately, even deep into the campaign, even into January, much of this was still being seen as aspirational. It's like, wow, if we win, we can do this, right? Or maybe if we build a movement, we can do this. This isn't about building a movement at this point. We need movement.
It's a necessity. It's a necessity.
Yeah, it's just, this is unavoidable reality.
And as a boomer, all right, as an old fart, let me also remind you, and I have young daughters, is that when you look at my lifetime experience versus their lifetime experience, in their lifetime, it's been 9/11. In their lifetime, it's been the war in Afghanistan. In their lifetime, it's been 2008. In their lifetime, it has been the acuteness of climate change, where we're really seeing the ice caps melting and we're recognizing the consequence. In their lifetime now, there's a pandemic. In their lifetime, there is such enormous student debt that it's exceeded credit card debt and auto debt and everything. So if you just look at what they have lived in their adult lives, it is a necessity.
Yeah. And here's the one thing I'll say, honey. Let me stop her and agree with Arnie here and then say one final thing. I actually, as a historian of politics, will tell you, I think that you have elections that are transformational moments because the things that were happening before were so overwhelming and there was so much going on that you couldn't help but have that election matter. It was going to be a choice to go one way or the other. 1932 was such a moment. Everybody gets excited about Franklin Roosevelt and they talk about the New Deal. Well, without 1932, Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal wouldn't have happened, right? The people gave the power to these folks and said, go do amazing things because we're in a really bad situation right now.
Exactly, exactly.
Similarly, in 1980, whether we like it or not, we had just gone through the Vietnam War, the 1960s, Watergate, and a host of other things. We had had the Arab oil embargoes and, you know, all the downturns. So frankly, a really scorching recession that had occurred during that time. People were feeling very uncomfortable. And Ronald Reagan came along and said, oh, government's the problem. We got to get rid of it. And you had a transformational election. I happen to not like the transformation, but doesn't matter. That's what happened, 1980, like 1932. Now, I'm not very good at math, Arnie. I'm not making any big claims. But if you kind of do your math and you go from 32 to 80, that's a certain period of time. We now go from 80 to now. That is another period of time. And we are in a moment that anyone will tell you is as scorchingly and overwhelmingly transformational as certainly the Depression era. I think we're looking at unemployment like you can't believe. We are looking at, you know, issues that we cannot resolve. Again, I think the 70s different, not as big a moment, but still the malaise, the trauma. We are now looking at an election that is in that zone. And so if that is the case, then there is a very good likelihood that people are going to give a lot of power to someone and some party to do a lot of stuff. My gut instinct is it is probably going to be the Democratic Party. They will have a very short amount of time in which to literally do all sorts of stuff. And if they don't do it, this country is in dire straits.
I'm listening to President Trump in that bizarre press conference he had the other day, which basically said that he had total power to do anything. Yeah. And I'm listening to what you're just saying right now. And there's the difference between the two power structures is that the power that you're talking about is the power that comes from the people that says, fix it.
Yeah, go do but something.
The power that you're hearing from Donald Trump is the power grab. And a power grab basically says, I don't give a crap about you. This is about me. Yeah. What you are talking about, which is so transformational, is that people are seeing the urgency and the necessity, as you said, and they're saying, I am empowering you to make this change. And that is celebratory in a lot of ways, because it does come from the bottom. It does mm-hmm. come from the voters. It does come from recognizing the failures of the moment and saying, I am empowering you to fix it. And in a way, this conversation is such an incredible contrast to Donald Trump's bizarre presser the other day, because it really does speak to what is at the balance of the November 2020 election.
That's it.
Do you want to reelect the power grab, or do you want to empower the change that you know must happen? And both of them are powerful, but they have such dramatically different results, and they come from such different places.
And let me agree with you, Arnie. This is how we always talk. We always get into the moment of just jumping, and let me jump right in here and say that in the in moments in history, we have had people who have spoken to this, the poets that would tell us that we might hope for the future because, you know, things really are possible. The anthropologists like Claude Levi Strauss, who would tell us that golden age is in us. We don't have to look to somebody else for something. We create perfection, if you will. Chilean folk singer Victor Jara said in that remarkable moment, take hold of your destiny. The future begins today. You know, all of these ideas, all of these ways, which are frankly as much and more expressed in the arts than they are in politics, you know, come to a head at certain moments. Whether we like it or not, I think we've gotten to this moment. And the weird thing about it is some of our more troublesome political analysts have said, well, you know, the only way this country is ever going to change is if it's just incredibly traumatized, right? Another depression or something like that. I've never liked that way of thinking, but, you know, that's sort of what's happened. We have gotten to that point where the notion that we're going back, that there's going to be some sort of restoration of a quote unquote normalcy, that's ridiculous. That is absurd. I write about technology, and the fact of the matter is we are going to see a massive robotification of industries because we have seen the vulnerability of situations where factories and warehouses and that might have a pandemic disease. Right? So I can't begin to emphasize that what comes next economically will be very, very different. And it is going to put all sorts of challenges on us. We also have all the planning challenges, all the other challenges that we have to deal with. It is not about a specific platform. It is not about a specific agenda. It is about an ability to say, we are at a certain place, and it is right now a lousy, scary, overwhelming, challenging, disappointing, unsettling place where we all know somebody who just became unemployed, and we all know somebody who's going to become unemployed, and we all know somebody who's sick or who may get sick. And it's overwhelming. And so what political leadership is about in a moment like that is to say, you have nothing to fear but fear itself. Well, in fact, in truth, we have more. We have a lot of things to fear.
Right, exactly.
It's to rise above it and to then say, give me the power, give us the power to fundamentally change things and make it less bad, make it actually perhaps good.
We began this conversation with the words of Barack Obama in his endorsement of Joe Biden. But in it, the part we pulled was the part about Bernie. And what you heard from Barack was, we're not going back.
That's right.
We have to go forward. There has to be dramatic change. He, in a lot of ways, was echoing in his more subtle way exactly what we have been saying. Yeah. And I think that was always the fear of a lot of people, that if Joe Biden got the nomination, that it was about sort of the return to normalcy. It was the idea that we could just go back. And what you heard from Barack Obama was, that's not why I'm endorsing Joe Biden. This is not about going back. This is about actually looking forward with a very vibrant and necessary agenda. And I am grateful for that. And I am grateful for Bernie. And I'm grateful that Bernie had the courage to come from a state the size of a suburb, to come as a democratic socialist, never in the party, you know, who managed to literally by himself capture a party and return it back to the place where I think it historically had thought of itself as being, which is a place of people, of workers, of the environment, of the idea that we're in this together, that sense of community that I think really defines the Democratic Party. And you saw that sense of community when you saw those 24 candidates running for president at the very beginning in 2019. And I'm looking at this, you know, conga line of people going, oh my God, but I'm smiling because it's America.
And it looked
like America.
And the Democratic Party has struggled with that.
Exactly.
Now, here's one final element of this, going into the mix, because this is the exciting, scary, and challenging part of it. We know the Republican Party. We know what the Republican Party is today. It's not a mystery. And what the Republican Party is today is a party that defaults to certain positions. Their position in the November election will be to argue that we hopefully have come out of the worst of the pandemic, right? We are trying to rebuild an economy, and that the way to do that is with economic austerity, that we will have to balance budgets, we will have to make people suffer because we helped them a little bit in this period, and that somehow we will have to give more money to the really rich guys so that they can trickle down some help to us, right? You know that's what they will say. Their platform is already written. The Democratic response has to not be just to say no, but to actually have a vision for how we go forward without austerity, with economic fairness, with taxation. And you know what's going to be required? We've talked quite a bit about Roosevelt in this. You know, we talk about Obama and his nuance. We talk about Biden and Sanders. Let me talk about Franklin Roosevelt. The only reason that Franklin Roosevelt succeeded was because he said to a portion of the elites in the United States, I welcome your hatred.
You know, and on that note, I need to say, au revoir to the man who I can never hate but only love. John Nichols writes in The Nation magazine. It's always a pleasure. And I'm so glad that we had Barack to start us and John to end us.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the day the telephone girls, as they were called, walked out on strike against New England Bell, essentially crippling communications in five New England states. It was considered the most massive strike of women workers since the uprising of the 20,000 in 1909. They were members of the all-women National Telephone Operators Department of the IBEW. Historian Stephen Norwood devoted many pages to the strike in his book, Labor's Flaming Youth. The government had taken over the nation's telephone and telegraph industries during World War I and placed it under the control of Postmaster General Albert Burleson. Just days earlier, thousands of angry women who worked in the Boston exchanges packed Faneuil Hall demanding immediate strike action. Julia O'Connor, the leader of the Telephone Operators Union, called for the strike on this day at 7 a.m. The union demanded a 60% wage increase and full scale to be reached after 4 years
instead of 7. Union and non-union alike responded to the strike call and walked off the job, establishing 24-hour picketing. On the second day of the strike, over 1,000 striking telephone operators marched through the streets of Boston and were cheered on by returning soldiers. O'Connor organized picketing around the Boston hotels, where out-of-town strikebreakers were housed. Unionized service workers across the city denied services to the scabs. Postmaster Burleson smeared the striking women as unpatriotic and threatened to replace them with returning soldiers. The soldiers, however, sided with the telephone operators. After 5 days, the union won direct bargaining rights and a $4 a week raise. The strike was considered one of the few post-World War I strikes to end in victory.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
This is our life, and these are the times. We are the people, and the dream is alive. Give us the strength to be humble and kind, and respect one another, leaving no one behind. From the mountains and valleys that stretch to the sea, a brand new America is calling to me.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So I'm grateful that I've had Greg Hoffman on before, because I'm on his mailing list. And he sends me an article. And I thought, oh, I'll read it later. And then I read it and I went, oh God, I gotta get him. The title of Greg Hoffman's piece is COVID-19 and the Unfunded Black Belt Commission. Black belt, and I'm thinking karate. And I'm like, no, that's not what this is about. Greg Hoffman is a contributing writer to The Nation magazine and the founder of TalkPoverty.org. And Greg, I welcome you to the program. And yet at the same time, I'm so pissed off at you because I never knew about this. I never knew. And I am mortified at what has happened to it, how it languished. I'm mortified because they created a version of it for the sort of northern states along the Canadian border, and that had the right advocates and got the money. And yet the place that needed it the most, the people that were desperate for the investment, they didn't see anything. So I'm going to welcome you to the program, and I want you to talk about the Southeast Crescent Regional Commission and about this concept that I have never heard of. And now I'm really angry because I would have been an advocate for it a long time ago, but for whatever reason, it's still this dirty little secret. But now, if there was ever a time for it to be exposed, it is now. So welcome to the program.
Well, Arnie, thank you for having me on, and I'm glad to piss you off. If it makes you feel better, it seems like nobody knows about this thing. I've learned about it in the last few months, and it is pretty stunning. And you're talking about, you know, more than $300 million that should have been going to this region since 2008 when the commission was funded, and it's only gotten $250,000, no more than that in any year. And this is money that's supposed to go towards healthcare deserts, towards infrastructure development, towards job training for good jobs, towards transportation. I mean, are these things that we could see perhaps being helpful right now in rural America during the coronavirus crisis? I think so.
All right, so let's go back to the beginning. So yeah. 2008,
yep.
It is frickin' 2020.
Yeah.
So tell me what happened in 2008. What was the idea? It wasn't just for the South. There was also one for the North. So explain to me, how did it originate? What was the raison d'etre? Who were the people that created this concept for both the South and the North? And then take us from there, because I want people to know what has been funded, which is the Northern version, and what was sort of the impetus behind this Southern version that never, ever really got the investment or got off the ground.
Yeah, well, what's really crazy is as long as it seems that it wasn't funded since 2008, they'd been working, advocates and scholars from the South had been working to create this commission since I think going back to the 80s, Tuskegee, some scholars at University of Kentucky, okay. a couple of other institutions, and they got a study commissioned. Actually, Zell Miller, of all people, wow. got, I think, like $1 million or something appropriated for a study for this, could this commission be created? The idea was that it would be similar to the Appalachian Regional Commission, which was created back in 1965. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the study showed that it was certainly needed, certainly feasible, that the persistent and generational poverty and lack of resources in the Black Belt were pretty astounding, but so too were the resources and the community and the things people had been able to work through with no resources. So, I mean, that's one thing I'd emphasize is when you talk to people in the Black Belt, they tend to emphasize their strengths and that there's just been a lack of investment in these strengths. They're not emphasizing just the problems that they're facing. And so finally, I believe there were actually various bills before 2008 to try to create this commission. And for whatever reason in 2008, maybe it was this compromise by also creating a Northern Borden Regional Commission.
Yeah, exactly.
For New Hampshire, New York, I'm blanking.
Maine and Vermont. Yes. Right.
And so they created both. And here we are now in 2020, and you've got the Northern one has been funded steadily, including $25 million in 2019. Oh, and to God. Their credit, all the delegations from these states push for funding every year. And I think that's what I've heard is the big difference in the South. Especially in the Senate, you just don't have champions who are saying, look, we got to fund this thing. Congressman Clyburn's been steady in pushing for this, but you know, you need partners on the Senate side. And he just, from what I'm told, has not had them. And so, I mean, technically all that has to happen is the president needs to appoint a federal co-chair, and then this commission could start going through appropriations to get the money that it's supposed to receive. So neither George W. Bush, Barack Obama, or the current guy they call president, were appointed this federal co-chair. And I think in 2008, of course, with the Great Recession, I think, you know, Obama struggled to get his $1 million stimulus or $1 trillion stimulus through. I'm sure funding a Southern commission wasn't going to be very politically palatable.
He was president for 8 years. I'm sorry.
I was going there. Okay, and I don't know the story beyond that, except that what the advocates say is we need Senate champions. I mean, we've got two Democratic senators now in Kane and Warner. Warner, yeah. And neither of them, I never hear about it from them.
Right.
So
has anyone sort of fed this to Joe Biden since he was rehabilitated? I mean, this is the Clyburn presidency and the Obama presidency. Biden happens to be in between the two of them. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. If it wasn't for Obama and it wasn't for Clyburn, there'd be no Joe Biden. Okay.
Right.
Now, knowing that, and I'm a little disgusted that Obama never did anything in a way to sort of invest in this. I mean, I think it's interesting to me. I think the greatest disappointment I have in Barack Obama is that he did so little for the African-American community. Yeah. It was almost like he felt like he was burdened because he was the first Black president, that somehow if he did something, they would basically sort of suggest that, aha, see, this is what happens. But what I think is so ironic is that I think a lot of poor whites were thinking, well, if he does something with poor Blacks, we probably all benefit as well. Yeah. So he could have done it because there are actually more poor white people than there are poor Black people. And in his way of targeting something like this commission, while it may be the Black Belt that it's called, there are a lot of white people Absolutely. That would have benefited from this.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that you point out in the commission, especially as you look at the version that did get funded in the North, a lot like New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine, and New York, yeah. is that it's not just the $25 million or the $30 million that goes in. It's that this money gets leveraged with so many other private dollars and
That's
other right. public dollars
That's
that
right.
the enormity of the loss since 2008
yes.
is mind-boggling. That's
yeah.
the part, Greg. And explain to people And we've actually seen it with the northern version. So we could just imagine what could have happened with the southern version.
And the statistics I have, so there's this other commission, as I mentioned, the Appalachian Regional Commission.
Right.
And that's been around for, that gets the most funds of any of them. And that's been around since 65. And if you look at 2019, their congressional appropriation was $176 million. But matching funds that you just mentioned from other state, local, federal, private resources were $246 million. So, you know, in 1 year, you know, you do the math, I think you're talking about more than $400 million. So if you look at $300 million in funding to the Black Belt, I'm sure you're looking at close to, over these years, you know, $800 million in leveraged funds. So, yeah, and there were additional monies from private investors that I don't have at the top of my head. But so it's a huge loss. There's just no way around it. And I think it's really, you know, thrown into it's really highlighted right now when people don't have the healthcare they need in terms of these healthcare deserts, when people are working in risky, low wage work. And so this was the time to bring it up. I actually did write another piece about this during when there were still lots of primary candidates hoping that it would be picked up before South Carolina. I wrote another piece.
I'm just telling you, you've got to get this out now because everyone's going, oh my God, you know, 26% of the community is Black, but 80% of the deaths are Black. Oh my God. Everyone's like, it's like a come to Jesus moment. Yeah, I didn't know. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you could have called me. You know, I mean, we've known for a long time what this deficit of investment, what this deficit of healthcare, what this deficit of infrastructure has meant. This is now a wonderful opportunity to sort of revive this, to explain that since 2008, it has not been invested. I mean, there was, the structure was there, but the dollars never came there. It never happened there. So if you want to know about the consequences, I always feel like we're going back to 9/11, where you were always talking about sort of what were the underlying causes. We weren't allowed to talk about that. You know, you can't talk about that. Well, you know what? Now is the time to not only talk about the failure that we see in bold relief, because we can count the bodies, you know, because we can count the people that have contracted it, because we have counted the people who can't stay at home and shelter in place, because that's not the nature of their jobs and that's not the nature of their economy. And they are forced into these very risky situations. And then you point this out and it just, once again, it mirrors and explains the failure, because when the opportunity existed, we walked the other way. You mentioned Appalachia. So talk to me about, have we looked at the consequences of this investment in Appalachia? Has it made a difference? Because what people are going to say is, oh, but you know what? Have we just been writing checks? But we still know that it's pretty poor in Appalachia. So has it done any good?
Yes, there is still poverty in Appalachia. Yeah. But you're talking about in 1965, Appalachian poverty was 31%. And today, that region that the ARC covers, it's around 17%. Wow. High poverty counties went down from 295 to 107. And yeah, so there is, and it's not all about the commission, but the commission's done a lot of work. And you know, yes, there's still poverty, but if it's the difference between having a clean water treatment center and not. It's a difference between having a healthcare clinic and not. It's a difference between having job training in computer technology and not. I mean, this commission was supposed to focus to the Black Belt Commission on clean energy jobs. I mean, so it's not just the continuing existence of poverty does not prove that these things are not.
And I'm not saying, I mean, this
oh,
is.
Oh, I know you're not saying that.
Right. But what I want people to understand is that what you saw in Appalachia was that there was a synergistic effect. It alone was not going to change things, but it mixed in with everything else, created a result that was an improvement that, if it had not been for this investment, may not have happened, or happened in a way that was more robust.
That's right.
I think this is also an opportunity for, you know, we began our show today with Barack Obama's endorsement of Joe Biden and his eloquence about Bernie Sanders. And what I think is, and Barack says, there are things I did not do, that there are things we must do, that I would not be doing today what I said in 2008, that there are things that were left on the table. Well, this was freaking left on the table,
right?
Okay? And this is a wonderful opportunity for Joe Biden to grab Jim Clyburn, because you mentioned Jim Clyburn is a big champion of this, and for Jim and Joe to say, let me tell you a story about 2008,
yeah.
Okay? As everyone's shocked about the number of, you know, minorities and Hispanics and Blacks that are dying from this, that have been so underserved. Well, part of the reason they've been underserved is that we shut the door on this. Right. And part of the reason why I am running for president, says Joe Biden, with Jim Clyburn under his arm,
right,
is that Jim didn't have the echo chamber in the White House.
Right.
And now he does.
Right.
And that echo chamber is reading about this and recognizing it and seeing the consequences of that failure and saying, this is not something that is, as John tells me, I shouldn't say doable, but is necessary. And we have the proof. And the proof has been coming out in huge numbers all over the country, not just in the Black Belt, but frankly everywhere. But if we don't focus here, then guess what? We're going to continue to see those horrific consequences.
That's right. And I mean, this is, you nailed it. This is Joe's chance to make right on something that they failed to do over 8 years. And also, I've been trying to get through to Congressman Clyburn's office to find out if they're, you know, pushing Joe a little bit. I mean, Joe, you know, as I write in the piece, he resuscitated that campaign, Clyburn and Black voters.
Yeah.
And so if this is a really important commission to Clyburn, and it seems to be, you know, come on, now's the time.
Okay, so I got an idea. So listen to this. My idea is this. So we mentioned that the Northern version has been funded.
Yep.
Okay. And the Northern version is a version that I know very well. Why? Because I'm from New Hampshire. Because I know the senators personally from New Hampshire. I know the senators personally from the great state of Vermont. I sort of know the senator from Chuck Schumer sat in front of me once at a funeral. So I kind of know the New Yorkers and Nate I'm familiar with as well. I think this is also an opportunity to go to Jean Shaheen and to go to Bernie and to go to Patrick Leahy and say, we have seen the success of the Northern version and have them also be the echo chamber for what was never funded in the South. And have them say, this was our privilege. This should not be a privilege. It should be an investment. And if the investment was wise for us, the investment is wise and essential for them. And actually, not just look to the Southern senators, which tend to be Republican and tend to be knuckle-dragging when it comes to these kinds of investments, and use this group of progressive Northern senators who've been able to advocate and see the success of that investment and say, but it can't just be for us. The rationale was they were both set up virtually at the same time with the idea that there would be parallel tracks, but instead one track got served and the other one got failed.
That's right.
And I think I would be bringing in the Jean Shaheens and the Maggie Hassans and the Chuck Schumers and the Pat Leahys to say, we are going to advocate with you because we get it.
And I love that idea.
Greg, I'm going to beg you to figure out a way to do it. And you know what? The Bernie Biden thing?
Yeah.
You got the shtick. Yes, Ken.
You got the connects, though. I don't have the connects. I'll come to the meeting, but I think we've got to make this happen.
Well, you know what? This is an opportunity for Bernie to help make the meeting, Bernie and Patrick to help make the meeting, because now Bernie's in the best place. And I got a better idea. Can you believe this on the radio? My idea is to get Bernie to call Jim Clyburn. Oh, that's the way to do it. Get Bernie to call Jim. And Bernie to say to Jim, we get it because it's worked for us. You get it because you know you need it. Let's figure out how to bring us together with you now that we're looking at a potential Joe Biden presidency.
I was going to say, adding to that, you folks are talking about the presidents, and certainly Obama and Biden didn't do anything in the 8 years that they were in control of at least the executive branch. But the fact is that they weren't in control, at least for 6 years, of Congress. And right, that was made everything that they did so much harder. But where I was going with this was that they got funding for the Northern Commission and Appalachian, but not the South made me think, well, guess what? Which political party has a Southern strategy and which political party has many of the senators, the congresspeople, the governors in that state are the Republicans, whose agendas may be, yes, we want military bases in our states, but they really don't want to spend money on any kind of social programs that benefit anybody, including people in their states. So I'm wondering, number one, if in addition to blaming or trying to bring Biden on board, we can also look at it as going after the Republican senators, and the Dems are trying to win back the Senate, and maybe that can be a strategy for some of the Democratic candidates in the southern states to say, hey, look, our region sought to have this almost $1 trillion coming here to help our people, and it was stymied. Let's have senators who will support it, not just bring the northern senators down, in addition to bringing the northern senators down to say we saw it work.
Greg, as I'm listening to this, another value of having these northern senators speak to the issue is that they have seen the result. They have seen the benefit of the investment, and they can look at those southern senators and they can say to them, so what is it about you that you do not want to see your citizens thrive, that you don't want to see this opportunity? We are proof of it working. You are proof that you choose not to make that investment. And I think in a way it's almost like shaming them.
Yeah.
And yet, given what is just happening now with the pandemic, I think shaming has more power than we've ever known. And I think Republicans are going to be sensitive to that shaming because these numbers are overwhelming. The economic despair is incredible. And the sense that we have to make rational investments or their states fall apart, I think now is probably more the time than ever. How sad that we had to wait so long for it to happen. But I do think that there is a chance now, especially now, for it to be realized. And I think the realization is going to really speak to all of us in such a powerful way. And I am just so grateful, Greg, that you wrote about it, because I'm still mortified that I didn't know about it. But you know what? Now I do.
Yeah. No, and like I said, you're hardly alone. Even, you know, a lot of advocates in the South were saying, what? When did this happen? And why hasn't this been created, you know, funded? So I appreciate your passion for it and would love to be a fly on the wall in any of those meetings you can put together.
Well, I was not even aware of the Northern version. But that's not going to be a surprise, because again, but I think that also gives me a sense of that I can see the consequence, that I'll be able to find the consequences of this, and then say to my senators and say to Patrick Leahy and to Bernie, here is a wonderful opportunity to sort of build on Bernie's message in a lot of ways, but build on a message with a program that was already there.
That's right.
But that to me is, I mean, Bernie's talking about change. I'm talking about investing in what should have been.
That's right.
You know, and yet isn't that ironic? Because that will be the change.
You know, do you have a sense of why that it didn't happen? I mean, you would think that when the commissions were created, or when the Northern commissions were doing whatever they needed to do to get the money appropriated, why didn't the Southern anybody go after it or talk about it?
So let's see. So again, in the 2006 or 2008, I think the recession was part of what held it back. And I think the appropriation for the Northern region was pretty small at that time too. I can't remember offhand. I think after that, you know, what I heard from the advocates who were involved with this, the only thing they all agreed on was the lack of any Senate champions, as opposed to the Northern region,
right,
where you have had even bipartisan senators championing it. So that was the big difference. I want to tell you a quick story about working with these Southern electeds. One of the advocates had a meeting back around Super Tuesday with aides to a Southern governor, who said, "Oh yeah, we're supportive, but we're worried that all these convenings you are doing to tell people about it will, quote, create a groundswell of polarizing demographics for red state senators."
Ooh. Oh,
so like, so is there one demographic that's not polarizing? And they're, you know, obviously talking about African-American people And I just found it stunning that they were that open to say that to an African-American woman advocate. She took it in stride and kept up the convenings and shared that story with me. So,
well, but they, you know, I mean, the Republicans are wearing their agenda on their sleeve in a way that before it was subtle, you know, and they were trying to, they would, and now they almost feel like they have a license to be as cruel and as harsh and anti-democratic and say, I want your vote. I don't want your vote. I want you to have access to the voting booth. It's unbelievable how they have decided that they can celebrate that they don't want to represent these people. They don't want, they don't see them as part of their community of interest, and they will not make investments in them, which is another reason why I go back to the Northern strategy and to say to those Northern senators, then you need to be the voice to support this.
Yes.
You need to be the champion. If it's not going to happen with an Alabama senator, it's not going to happen with a Mississippi senator, it's not going to happen with a Georgia, then it needs to happen because you carry it. Let them say no, but you be the voice that says, we need to make this investment.
That's right.
And I just think, and again, one of the things I love about being a U.S. senator, although I never ran for one, was that, you know, you're one of 100. And every one of those U.S. senators imagines that someday they will be president. So they're always looking at sort of the bigger podium. Well, this is an opportunity for these Northern senators to really look at the country as a whole and say, we're one of 100, but we represent the nation, not just our state. And this is inexcusable. And I see that as an opportunity. I am grateful and depressed, Greg Kaufman, that you wrote this piece, but I want everyone to make sure that they go to my Facebook page or the Attitudes Facebook page. The title is COVID-19 and the Unfunded Black Belt Commission. Thank you so much for writing it, and thank you for joining us.
Ain't gonna let nobody